I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Joshua Samuel Brown. Joshua spent the better part of the first decade of the 21st century roaming around East Asia and writing for a variety of publications before writing his first book of short stories, Vignettes of Taiwan. This book helped him land steady work with Lonely Planet, on whose behalf he journeyed for several years through Asia and Central America before, according to Joshua, going slightly mad and deciding to settle down in Portland, Oregon.
No place else would have me.
He's here in our studios today to talk about his new book of travel stories, How Not to Avoid Jet Lag, and Other Tales of Travel Madness. Joshua Samuel Brown, thanks for being here on Between the Covers.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
The very first page is a dedication, and it reads, "To Wanderlust, Cause and Cure for My Madness." When did you first get that first whiff of wanderlust?
Probably when I was 9 years old. No, it was 1980, so I would have been 10 years old. And it was the day that John Lennon was murdered. And I was 10 years old. And when I heard on the radio that John Lennon had been killed, I skipped out of school that day. I must have been in fifth grade. And I actually hopped on a bus, went across Staten Island, which is where I grew up, hopped on a ferry, which I had never done myself, and then snuck onto a subway and went up to the Dakota, where I snuck into the Dakota by pretending to be a child who lived there in order to, as I told the front desk guard, comfort Yoko Ono. That was probably my first ever travel adventure. I used to skip out of school a lot and go on these very long journeys. We're talking when I'm 11, 12, 13, 14.
Like subway journeys or
I would go out of New York City. When I was a freshman in high school, I was studying German, so I adopted a German exchange student persona to sneak on trains.
With an accent?
I would say, some man has taken my wallet. I must get back to New Haven. I would get on the Long Island Railroad. I would get on, the trains up to Connecticut. And I just get on the trains and then get off at some random stop and wander around. And the German exchange student thing was because I didn't have enough money to actually pay for the train tickets. So I guess this was sort of the earliest inkling that I got that by basically making up stories, I could get free travel.
Now, how'd you get from Connecticut to Taiwan? Trips to Connecticut.
The trips to Connecticut. That was actually the trip to Connecticut, I think, was to see the Grateful Dead, if I recall correctly. My memories from the mid-80s are hazy for various reasons. I first moved to Taiwan after graduating from school, about 2 years after I got out of school, and I just went there to teach English. My idea was that I would go there for 2 years, make some money, and come back. And it didn't turn out that way. I met a girl while I was there, and I wound up really falling in love with the country and the culture. And I stayed there for most of the 1990s before moving on to mainland China. And I lived there at various points in Beijing and Yangshuo, which is a very beautiful little town in Guangxi province. I lived in Yunnan, and I always just sort of wrote and bopped around China before finally going back to Taiwan, where I wrote the book Vignettes of Taiwan. And then I kind of foisted that upon Tony Wheeler, who was then the owner and still the founder of Lonely Planet. I foisted it upon him at a book club meeting in Hong Kong. And he apparently liked it because he offered me the gig working on my first Lonely Planet gig, which was Taiwan's 7th edition.
How many Lonely Planet guidebooks did you author or co-author?
I've authored and co-authored 13 in some cases, like when I do my Belize book, I'll also sometimes do research for the Central America on a Shoestring book. So it's one trip, but I'll get two books out of that.
How many languages do you speak besides English, of course?
I speak English. I speak Mandarin Chinese. I can start a conversation in Taiwanese, and I can start a conversation in Taiwanese enough so that Taiwanese people are impressed, and then I generally have to switch to Mandarin. But it comes in handy.
They're very similar?
They're quite different.
Oh.
they sound, to you, they might sound the same, but they sound very different. Would you like an example?
Oh, yeah.
哎,我跟你讲,我现在说国语. That is Mandarin. That is, I'm telling you, I speak Chinese.
And in Taiwan?
哎,我跟你讲啊,我讲大意啊.
They actually sound very different to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to insult you.
Okay.
It won't be the first time. It won't be the last time. And it's certainly not the first time.
Very discriminating here.
Sorry, you're good.
And you speak Spanish too?
No.
Oh. So how do you get by in Belize?
I do Belize.
Belize
is an English-speaking country.
Oh.
Belize, they speak this very interesting patois of English. English is the national language of Belize, but they speak Garifuna, which I can't speak a word of, but it's a beautiful language. They do speak Spanish there, but my friends who are Spanish speakers say that they speak Spanish in the same way as they speak English. That is to say, very different than standard Spanish or English. So Belize is an English-speaking country. When I went to Guatemala, I learned yo soy un... I can't even say anymore. I am the writer of a guidebook. It was the Belize... The Guatemala thing was just one chapter of the Belize book, so it wasn't that extensive. And I was traveling with a very crazy woman who had tattooed eyebrows who spoke Spanish. So she helped me.
And I'm interested how you get started writing a guidebook. I noticed in the foreword of the book, which we actually will discuss in this interview, I promise, Tony Duchesne, who writes the foreword, describes it this way. A month traveling through exotic lands sounds fun, but as Joshua will tell you, a good chunk of that month will be spent hurriedly scribbling bus schedules, surreptitiously inspecting hotel rooms, and making secretive visits to restaurants to ascertain rumors that their toilet, which is actually a hole in the ground, has seen better decades. Is that a pretty accurate description?
That's pretty accurate. A lot of what I do, I mean, there's this idea that guidebook writing is, you know, this incredibly glamorous profession and that you're sitting, you know, at a five-star hotel on the beach being, you know, fed margaritas and lobster tails. That is not true. For one thing, with Lonely Planet, we don't take freebies. So that kind of nixes the lobster tails. Also, as you know from reading my book, I have gout, so no margaritas or lobster tails for me.
There's a very graphic story in the book, by the way, about a gout attack.
I'm especially proud of my being able to describe the agony of gout attacks, which, frankly, I would trade all that for not having gout. But there you are. That's the luck of the genetic draw.
Were you then in incognito when you were visiting hotels, restaurants,
generally
and writing
speaking,
about them?
Generally speaking, I go incognito, especially when I'm in Taiwan. I just go incognito. Sometimes I say, oh, I'm a guidebook writer. I'd just like to check out a hotel room. It really depends. The thing is about Taiwan is that they don't know that much about Lonely Planet or guidebooks there, so it doesn't make any difference to them. They're like, oh, okay. In other places, it really depends on the feeling. I'm going to read a little bit out of a story later. In Singapore, you know, I had to start going incognito because I knew that they would treat me differently if they knew that I was writing for a guidebook, and I wanted the unfiltered view. In Belize, the problem is Belize has a population of, you know, I think 200,000, and apparently I know like 50,000 of those people at this point. It's a small country, and since I've been going there for so many years, you know, and like a third of my Facebook friends are now Belizeans. People know me there, so
you can't get away with anything.
I can't
in
go
Belize.
Incognito in Belize. Uh-huh. So people just know me, and it's like, oh, I'm coming every 3 years to sort of check if the prices have changed. But a lot of, you know, Tony's intro is accurate in that in Belize, a goodly portion of what I do is I go and I check bus schedules so that readers can know, you know, how they can get from Belmopan to Punta Gorda in, you know, a few hours and what time to show up at the bus station and stuff like that and price. But all that stuff always changes. And generally speaking, especially in Belize, they tend to, you know, write all the schedules in pencil on the wall and they just change every 3 months. So it's kind of a Sisyphean ordeal. Am I saying that right?
Oh, Sisyphean. Yeah, Sisyphus rolling the rock up the mountain and it
they,
coming
they
back down again.
They just change too much,
yeah.
But it's a lot of stuff like that.
An exercise in futility,
it's
I guess.
It's an exercise in futility. Belize is not the most well-ordered country in the world, which is interesting because the other place that I've done a lot is Singapore, which is probably the most well-ordered country that I've ever been to. And often I'll go from Singapore to Belize because those are the two books that I've done, you know, a good number of. And so I go from, you know, this completely chaotic country to this absolutely marvelously well-ordered country.
In the Lonely Planet guidebooks, do you have any leeway to include stories or impressions, or is it pretty much bus schedules, pricing?
Well, I mean, there's the journalistic stuff that I get to do with Lonely Planet is every book, I'll always include a few what are called local voices, and those are interviews with people. Generally, they've more and more they've become sort of Q&A, like I'll find a figure who is a musician or an artist or a notable figure, and I'll just ask them a quick Q&A, you know, what do you think the essence of Belizean music is? Where's your favorite place to eat or something like that? It used to be that I got to do more long-form journalism for Lonely Planet. There's a little bit less of that, but what I now do is I take that long-form journalism and I'll put it online. So I've done a whole bunch of stories for LP.com, LonelyPlanet.com, in which what I'll do is I'll take the things that I'd like to put into the books, but there's really no space for, and I'll get to be a lot more creative online. So it's kind of a win-win situation, and they're
and
looking for that,
more,
too.
And those are the more journalistic type
sure.
pieces, as you described.
One of my favorite articles that I've done for LP.com is I did an Asian street food battle, which I set up as being sort of a, like it was like watching a boxing match, but between, you know, these two countries, or it was actually two cities, Singapore and Taipei, as to which has the best street food. And I angered a lot of my Taiwanese friends by giving it to Singapore. I still get the occasional letter about that. But it was just by a hair that Singapore won. And it really was the cleanliness that put me over the edge. I did a story, I think it was called Four Chinese Weddings and a Taiwanese Funeral. Either that or How to Crash a Chinese Wedding. It was one or the other. But where basically I wrote about crashing weddings in China and inadvertently crashing a funeral in Taiwan because I thought it was a wedding.
So it seemed that was a way of getting the more creative side of your
sure.
travel impressions across rather than putting them in the actual Lonely Planet guidebook.
There was no space for them in the Lonely Planet guide. It was a little bit too esoteric. And, you know, then with the book that I just put out, How Not to Avoid Jet Lag and Other Tales of Travel Madness, this was the stuff that, you know, even LP.com wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole.
I could see why in certain respects.
A little bit
too
weird.
You make up a few things occasionally.
Can you prove that there's not a pyramid of human skulls in Vermont?
I've never been to Vermont, so
okay.
I assume
exactly.
there is.
Exactly. There could be.
Well, let's get to the book, Joshua.
Let's get to the book.
How Not to Avoid Jet Lag and Other Tales of Travel Madness. I can safely say it's a collection of travel stories, but not anything like a Lonely Planet guidebook. It's very funny and at times very weird. I was wondering what your initial idea for the book was.
Initially, after I did my last guidebook, I kind of went mad. I mean, not in a bad way. I did my last book. It was in Belize. I'd had a terrible gout attack. I remember climbing up to the Caracol Pyramid. It was 2012, the alignment. So it was that Maya alignment. And you know, basically, I was like, okay, I need to stop traveling for a little while. And so I came to Portland. I had fallen in love with Portland earlier. And yet I still missed traveling, but I didn't want to travel anymore. So what I did was I sat down, and over the course of a couple of months, I wrote down all of these very bizarre travel tales that I had either started while I was on the road and realized there's no way I'm going to be able to get LP.com or anybody else to run these. Although, let me backtrack. Two of the stories in this book actually did get printed in the Asia Literary Review, so I'm very proud of that. And one of them was actually a restaurant review that I did for a wonderful magazine called Beijing Scene in the year 2000, long before
was
I ever...
Was this the North Korean restaurant?
That was the North Korean restaurant.
Okay, we'll get to that one.
That was an actual restaurant
review.
That's
one of my favorite stories in the book.
But I took basically my weirdest stories and I put them together. And I have a good friend called David Lee Ingersoll who lives up in West Seattle, and I loved his illustrations, and we knocked around the idea of having him illustrate all the stories, and so we put those together.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO, and today we're talking with Joshua Samuel Brown, author of the new collection of travel stories, How Not to Avoid Jet Lag and Other Tales of Travel Madness. The restaurant review, we'll get into that one too, but that was one of my favorite stories. The other one, well, there's a few, but these stood out. Supper in Uyghurville, which is what I thought a Hunter Thompson-esque trip through a bad neighborhood, predominantly Muslim in Beijing in search of buying some hashish.
Basically, yes.
And your character in there is led by this very crazy journal editor there. He's given the name Severin Knowles. Does this have a lot of basis in fact?
This is a 100% accurate journalistic recounting of my first full night working for the magazine Beijing Scene. And it's okay because Severin Knowles is actually a my former publisher, Scott Savitt, who he has no problem. He loves this story. He is now living an almost monk-like existence out of China now. He's we still talk regularly. He loves the story. But
he was like that, though, in the...
He was intense. And that's what happened with Beijing Scene is a whole
seemingly
other story.
Seemingly oblivious to any danger.
No. In fact, years later, I don't want to misquote my good friend Severin Knowles, a.k.a. Scott Savitt. I think that basically this was only one of a series of misadventures that was perhaps a cry for help from him or his inner, you know, id sort of trying to make it clear that he also needed to make some changes in his life.
A little self-destructive.
I think that anybody who knows him would say that, yes. Now, of course, he had been living in Beijing for many, many... This is literally my second year, my second day in Beijing. And the thing that I guess I need to set up here is that I had been living in Taiwan for years. Taiwan is this very wonderful, safe society. You can drop your wallet on the street in Taipei, and chances are pretty good that someone will pick it up and run after you trying to find you. Not the case in Beijing anywhere, certainly not in, this was actually 1999, I misspoke, I said 2000, it was 1999, and certainly not in Beijing in the neighborhood that I call Uyghurville, a neighborhood that doesn't exist anymore, it's been long since knocked down. This was a dangerous, scary neighborhood, and the fact that my new employer was taking me there, you know, on basically a hashish scoring, you know, adventure my second night there, he was just trying to test me to see if I would go running for Beijing Airport and fleeing to go, you know, back to Hong Kong and then back to Taiwan. You couldn't fly directly from Beijing to Taiwan.
I would say you passed the test, though.
I passed the test.
Though barely.
I did just fine. I actually, you know, worked there for the rest of the summer. It was a summer gig, and it was one of the most formative periods of my, it was the most creative period of my life as a writer for a while.
In the other story, and you alluded to this before, that restaurant review, mm-hmm. It's called Cold War Cuisine.
Right.
And you visit a North Korean restaurant in Beijing for the purposes of reviewing it. The place is called Pyongyang Barbecue, which sounds made up, but I guess that was the real name of the place.
It was Pyongyang Barbecue.
And then, I wanted just to give the listeners some kind of the flavor here, and this just made me laugh out loud. There's a passage here I kind of underlined for you there.
I'm worried, however, by reading this, I will be alienating my potential anti-dog meat readers. So I should let people know that I no longer eat dog. And this was only one of two times that I ever knowingly consumed dog meat.
Okay, duly noted.
Is this your spiciest kimchi? I ask, my face turning scarlet. Our second most spicy. We would not serve a foreigner our most spicy kimchi unless we wished them dead. These will be the kindest words she says all night. Yes, no, that was 100% true.
I just couldn't believe it when I was reading it. Given our impression of North Korea now, it seemed very North Korean.
They were, and I never, you know, I was only 30 years old when I did that. So I didn't have quite the broad depth of political understanding as I do today. But I don't know whether or not the people who worked at that place were North Korean refugees who had snuck over, or they were just people who had come over as part of sort of a diplomatic crew to open up a restaurant so that North Korean diplomats would have a place to eat. I do know that we as white people were clearly unwelcome there. And, you know, when we went in there, they were very, very adamant about the fact that they weren't happy about the fact that we were doing a restaurant review and they didn't want us to take any pictures. And they weren't that happy to see us at all, which is why we had to lie to them and tell them that we were from Iceland.
So Iceland is a little more acceptable white person than an American or British.
I think it just threw them for a loop. they had no reason to suspect Icelanders.
Now the book, as you mentioned very clearly throughout, it's entertainment. It's not meant to give travel tips. You even joke that if there's anything in there, you didn't really mean it. But there are a few. There was one that stood out for me in the story Farewell, Hello Kitty, where you give us the secret of not getting sick on airline food. What is that secret, and is that really the
order
something
kosher
you learned?
Actually, I was being a bit tongue-in-cheek. Okay. The actual secret, order a kosher meal.
Okay. You said in the book, eat only the salad and dessert.
Basically, yeah. Okay. Don't ever eat the meat portion. Honestly, if and again, because with this book, I didn't want to give any useful travel advice. I held back a little bit. If I were giving useful travel advice, it would be order a kosher meal, order the vegetarian meal. But yeah, don't eat the meat portion of any sort of, unless you're in first class or business class, then you can eat whatever you want.
And of course, the title story of the book, How Not to Avoid Jet Lag, is excellent advice on how not to avoid it.
Absolutely.
Of course, you do everything you can to not avoid it.
Well, I used to think that I was immune to jet lag, and I just came back from a trip to Iceland and Norway, and you know, I was jet lagged for 5 days when I came back, which was unusual, and I think it's because it was the first time that I'd come back from that part of the world. Yeah, basically. I mean, if you want to know how to really make jet lag last, you can buy my book and follow my advice on how not to avoid jet lag.
And do the opposite.
And the thing is about, no, follow that advice.
No.
Then you will have jet lag. Jet lag's a good thing. I mean, getting up, you know, you get up at 4 a.m, it's your most active period of the day. You know, your girlfriend or boyfriend or your significant other is still asleep, so you can get some stuff done. Jet lag is great. I don't see why people don't like it.
Okay.
It's a ready excuse for not showing up to meetings.
Certainly one among many reasons to buy the book and read it.
Many reasons.
Joshua, to give the listeners a little more flavor of what they can find in the book, I asked you to read a section from a story called My Parents Are Little People. Again, this had me not quite on the floor laughing, but laughing out loud and making a fool of myself because I was reading in public.
I'm flattered.
Yeah, people were watching me.
Don't read my book in public.
Please don't. Yeah, you'll get very strange looks as I did. Anyway, this is from My Parents Are Little People.
I'll give you a little bit of a setup. In Singapore, I had started to go incognito as a guidebook writer because I had discovered that a lot of the 5-star hotels just didn't really want to give me the time of day. And because I need to look into rooms, I need to see what they look like, I just decided to pretend that I was just looking for a room. And what happened is after the first couple of days of doing that, I was getting bored. And I realized that if I was bored, then my readers on the end of the guidebook might be bored. So I decided to start having fun with it. This is from My Parents Are Little People. I began my rounds that day using my usual strategy for dealing with reticent hotel management. No longer a guidebook writer, today I'm Joe Q. Citizen, looking to help out some out-of-town friends book a future Singapore stay. With my digital recorder turned on inside the mobile phone holder resting on my shoulder, I take notes discreetly for later transcription. It's a workable solution, but by midday, something feels wrong. It isn't that I'm lying. Well, technically I am, but all in the name of providing you, my reader, with an accurate review. But that I'm bored. And if I'm bored, what about you, dear reader? And what about the entertainment of the hotel staff? I push through the revolving door of the next hotel, an exclusive double-towered place with an astronomical price tag, and make a beeline through luxury for the front desk. A lovely woman with the name tag Anne greets me with a smile. "Hi, Anne. I'm here to help my parents book a room for their upcoming visit," I tell her, giving a vague date of sometime in the next few months before launching into the exciting tale of my parents' upcoming journey. In the autumn of their lives, my parents have decided to visit the Far East, where I've been working for several years. The trip is a big deal for them. It's their very first time outside of the United States. I guess I should tell you, Anne, my parents have special needs. Special needs? Are they handicapped? Anne's tone indicates that the establishment is both well-equipped and proud to be of service to such guests. My parents are little people. Anne is visibly perplexed. She hasn't heard the term before. Little people? Little people. My father stands about this high. I hold my palm level with my solar plexus. And my mother? I continue, laughing breezily while raising my hand mid-ribcage. I guess you could say Mom's the tall one. Midgets! Anne's eyes brighten with excitement. Oh no, I shake my head earnestly. We must never call them that. They are little people. Little people. Anne tries the phrase on for size. You can imagine how hard it is for them to travel, I continue. In America, they often get stared at. Strangers pick them up and hug them. We will not let that happen here. The kindness of Singaporeans is well known. That's just one of the reasons they want to visit here. That, and of course, your famous cuisine. Anne, now an unwitting participant in my pointless deception, smiles at this unneeded bait. I think we can make their visit very memorable. Still smiling, Anne leads me to the mid-level elevators to begin the tour. The standard room boasts a king-size bed, plush carpeting, and a flat-screen television, perfectly acceptable for your average traveler. But I've suddenly decided that my little parents have deeper pockets and more discriminating tastes. What if they wanted something more elegant? Ah, in that case, they'll want the clubhouse floor. As the elevator whisks us to the upper levels, Anne explains the amenities of the clubhouse floor. I repeat salient snippets thoughtfully into my right shoulder. Harborview rooms, free breakfast, evening drinks. Each room on the clubhouse floor is done up in a combination of modern and British colonial-era decor and come equipped with a top-of-the-line Italian espresso machine. The floor-to-ceiling windows offer unparalleled views of both city and harbor. My little parents will feel like royalty. Do your parents like to swim? Anne asks. Oh, yes, but not if the water is too deep. They'll love our rooftop pool and jacuzzi. The roof induces instant vertigo. I shudder at the thought of how my tiny parents will feel. As we ride the elevator back to the lobby, Anne gives me her card, her hand lingering warmly against mine for several seconds. When you are ready to make arrangements, call me personally. I can offer your parents a discount, should they stay the full week.
I love that line, they like to swim, but not if the water's too deep.
I did that for a while. I did the little people thing. I did some other variants of abnormal body sizes for different hotel owners.
And I have to tell the listeners, that story is actually towards the beginning of the book, and things just get a little more way out as we go along.
The first three stories in the book, as are actually more than the first three, basically I would say the first half of the book is straight journalism. And then later, and the way that I arranged the stories initially, I was going to do the stories initially chronologically, and then I wanted to put them in, you know, Asia stories, Thailand stories. And then I realized that doing it chronologically was better because I begin going crazier. I basically, my madness increases as the stories go on, and that turns out to be sort of also in chronological order.
The Amazon website I looked, you have an author's website, and you have an awful lot of books on there too, in addition to the one we're talking about today. A lot of those are the Lonely Planet guidebooks.
But buy this one, because this is the only one that I get a cut from.
We've been talking with Joshua Samuel Brown, author of the new collection of travel stories, How Not to Avoid Jet Lag and Other Tales of Travel Madness. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Joshua for visiting us at KBOO and for all of you for listening.
I've been everywhere.